Welcome to the Weekly Fix, Asia Society's podcast with the latest news out of Asia and expert analysis you can only get here. I'm Alex Farbstein. It's Wednesday, October 8th. Today, central banks from around the world cut interest rates by up to 0.5% in a coordinated effort to remedy global financial turmoil. The cuts didn't help Asian markets, which closed significantly down before the announcement. Tokyo ended Wednesday down 9.4%, and the Hang Seng was down 8.2%. Asia Society's Hedda Barron talked to our new associate fellow, Zachary Carabell, president of River Twice Research. Zachary has taught at Harvard and Dartmouth and has written widely on economics, investing, and international relations. His forthcoming book is on the relationship between China and the U.S.
Asian markets plummeted Wednesday, so what does this signal?
I think it signals that there's a lot of people who are still sitting on the sidelines because it's unclear what direction these things are going. A lot of the selling globally is based on the fact that people aren't buying. That may sound like an obvious statement, but the degree to which people are selling and not buying is extreme right now. And the other thing is that there's a lot of selling in global equity markets that is purely a function of the collapse of global credit markets, in that if you need money and you need cash, the equity markets are one of the only places that you can go for that cash. It's not that the fundamentals underlying a lot of companies have collapsed completely overnight, even if some are weak. So I think that needs to be kept in mind, that there is a credit crunch globally that is negatively impacting equities. But that doesn't mean that the fundamentals of a lot of these companies are collapsing nearly as much as the credit market is.
Now, if you look at Asia, and economists there always stress that economic fundamentals are strong, and governments there sit on trillions of dollars of liquidity, why is it that Asian markets are down when there is great liquidity out there?
Well, one, you're completely correct that the underlying fundamentals of many of these economies, and China above all, China really is the linchpin here, but there are a lot of others that are either doing well because China is doing well or also doing well on their own, whether that's Vietnam, certainly India is a separate story, Singapore, Taiwan. There is still a global capital market, and to the degree that global capital flows through those markets as well as through the United States, everybody is somewhat implicated in the U.S. credit crunch. So some of that is simply because the world is interlinked, and so what happens in one part of the world, particularly if it's a large portion of the global economy, i.e. the United States, does impact not necessarily Asian economies, but it impacts Asian equity markets and credit markets. What's going to be interesting is that on the other side of this crisis, I believe you're going to see that cash position that you talked about before of these either central banks in Asia or a lot of corporations, which are not nearly as debt-ridden and are selling into very powerful domestic markets, again, in China or in Vietnam or elsewhere, are going to be in a much stronger position than a lot of the developed world, and may in certain respects be in a stronger position than the United States and Europe, although the United States and Europe will remain absolutely central and invaluable to the global economy.
You've said that this latest financial crisis will lead us to a new financial world. How will this change relations then between Asia and the U.S., and in particular, China and the United States?
Well, first of all, that relationship already is changing and has been changing. This is a particularly alarming wake-up call to structural shifts that have been going on for the past 5 years. People have been talking about the huge amount of reserves that the Chinese central banks have been accumulating because they've been purchasing such large amounts of U.S. treasuries, and they already have a treasury surplus in China of close to $2 trillion. Some of that's U.S., some of that's other countries' debt. So that's been known, but to the degree that there has been and clearly now is a structural shift in the global economy away from reliance on and dependence on U.S. capital and toward other areas of the world which are capital generating and goods generating, this is, I think, a real turning point in financial and global history that will mark a true globalization of finance. And while that does mean a relative decline of the United States, or at least a relative increase in the power of other countries and other markets, it's not all going to be as disruptive as the present would suggest.
It's time now for our segment, Heard At, Asia Society. With the U.S. presidential election just weeks away, Iran continues to figure prominently in both candidates' foreign policy. Both John McCain and Barack Obama have said that, if elected, they would work to toughen sanctions against Iran. And just yesterday, Britain's Foreign Secretary, David Miliband, told Parliament that sanctions are an important part of Britain's European and international agenda. Meanwhile, Iran maintains that its nuclear program is only for generating electricity. Foreign Minister Manoush Mottaki spoke at Asia Society about Iran's stance and its frustration with international scrutiny of its nuclear program.
You also referred to the nuclear issue. Last year, in this same forum, I explained. Well, at the end of the day, in the comments made by the officials of one country, in the positions taken by the officials of a country, their track record, there must be some indication that this country is diverting. And you, sir, also referred in your comments to Iran's history. It's very true. Our history dates back to thousands of years ago. And throughout these thousands of years, we have always tried to live side by side with our neighbors, to live in peace and harmony, to have constructive engagement. All Iranian leaders, all political and religious leaders, for that matter, have announced time and again that, to some extent, because of Islamic and Sharia considerations and teachings, WMDs have no place in our defense doctrine. To be more specific, atomic bombs have no place in our defense doctrine. Again, going back into Iranian history, no such thing has ever existed. We're also contending that nuclear weapons, as I said last year, are no longer effective. By the same token, military power or might has lost effectiveness. Despite all of these clear indications, they disregard all of these completely. And what they're saying is that in the dark corners of your mind, you might be entertaining certain ideas. We are not very sure about your intentions. Sometime down the line in the future, you might divert towards a bomb. Are we coming up and establishing a new judicial, international judicial system? Last year with the IAEA, we hammered out a new modality and reached an agreement. I explained for you the general outlines. 1.5 years ago in Madrid, we told the agency that we are very ready to respond, to provide answers to all of your questions. They came back and gave us a lot of questions, talked about a lot of things that were ambiguous for them. All of these were claims, allegations made by the U.S. and handed over to the agency. And we asked the agency, actually they finally admitted, came to acknowledge would be a better word, that they have no other questions, no other misgivings. Once they said that they have no other questions, we started answering their questions one by one. For each set of questions, once we were through, they sent us a written letter stating that your responses are adequate and complete. Once that project, for lack of a better word, was finished, I ask you, what expectations should Iran have? We were fully expecting for the 5+1 to come back and thank Iran and appreciate the effort Iran had put into providing answers to all of their questions and addressing all of their misgivings. And also we were again fully expecting in the September meeting for Iran's dossier to be put aside. But the agency's representative came to us, and he said that the American party has again given to the agency another series of misgivings, ambiguities, allegations, claims against your program. We asked the gentleman, what would your response be to this? He said that, well, we had set aside a specific time, and within that time period, all the parties which had questions, again, concerns, ambiguities, they were supposed to give them to us in that specific time period. And these questions we have received outside that time period. So again, in the context of that modality, we are very we are free to refuse, but we accept it. Iran responded by saying that, well, you might have accepted, but I don't see any need for me to accept. And all of these allegations, similar to the previous set of allegations, are baseless. We're not going to allow ourselves to be pushed into an unending road, a road which will be directed by the U.S. And, of course, before I continue, I apologize if I am passing judgment on the U.S. government's behavior so far, but my judgment is very much rooted in the events which have transpired.
It's time now to hear about what's going on at Asia Society around the world. I'm here with Elaine Mergarian, and Elaine's got a great exhibition for us.
We have two beautiful Islamic calligraphy exhibitions, which you can see at the museum in New York or online. Traces of the Calligrapher, Islamic Calligraphy in Practice, 1600 to 1900, and Writing the Word of God, Calligraphy and the Quran. These are two complementary exhibitions that explore Islamic art's quintessential art form, calligraphy. The practice of calligraphy, which constitutes an expression of piety, as stated in Hadith, which are sacred texts associated with the Prophet Muhammad.
As always, check out asiasociety.org for more special features, news, and commentary. I'm Alex Farbstein. Join us again next Tuesday for the Weekly Fix.